Welcome back to the Narrative Monopoly Podcast. On today's episode, we have someone who led the charge to get the CIA to release the files captured from bin Laden's compound. That guy is Tom Joselyn. Tom knows everything about the world of jihad. He has studied it for 20 years, and he gives us insights into the questions that you're probably wondering in the back of your mind, which is what's going on with Al-Qaeda? What's going on with the Taliban now that we're pulling out of Afghanistan? What happened to ISIS? And all of those relevant questions. And we even talk about a lot of the specific characters in Al-Qaeda and in that world. So this is one that you are not going to want to miss. Great primer on these subjects. So without further ado, let's press play. On today's podcast, we have Tom Joselyn. Tom is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and is an editor at FDD's Long War Journal, a widely read publication on counterterrorism and related issues. His main focus is on jihadism and how Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State operate around the globe. He has served as a consultant for FBI's Counterterrorism Division and has testified before Congress more than 20 times. He has constructed dossiers on hundreds of terrorists during the course of his work. He's been described as one of the most trusted authorities on the Al-Qaeda network because of his encyclopedia knowledge on terrorist biographies. And in 2017, as a result of his efforts, the CIA declassified and released the vast majority of the files captured in Osama bin Laden's compound. How did you get those files released, and how are you doing, Tom?
Well, Jeff, thanks for having me. How did I get those files released? That's a whole other podcast, I would say, to answer that question. It was basically just constantly beating the drum on the Hill and in Washington for the files. And I think it's probably for your listeners, it's probably better to back up for a second and talk about why I would get those files released, or why I agitated for the files to be put out there. It's one of the strangest things in all this that I've been working on for so many years now, is that there's still to this day is not a commonly accepted definition of Al-Qaeda as an organization, a terrorist organization, and then associated groups. There's no commonly accepted definition or hierarchy, or if you think about it, you know, a wire mapping of how this actual organization exists to this day. And that's very strange. You know, America has spent hundreds of billions, perhaps more, on this, what was formerly known as the War on Terror following 9/11. And yet I find to this, you know, this many years later, that if you go across the U.S. intelligence community or you go across the expert community, there's really no consensus on what this organization is or looks like as of 2021. In fact, there are some commonly held paradigms for it that are obviously flawed. They're obviously, we can talk about that. They're obviously wrong, but there's nobody can sit down and tell you, you know, here's what the entire sort of management structure of Al-Qaeda looks like. And how does the Al-Qaeda senior leadership interact with groups around the world? None of those basic questions are really being answered on a regular basis. And that's very strange. And the Bin Laden files to me were one of the best primary source documents that could be used to sort of set a baseline for Al-Qaeda to understand what the organization is. If you go back through what the CIA and others were talking about at the time, prior to the Bin Laden raid in May of 2011, there was commonly believed that Bin Laden was basically this spiritual figurehead who was out of the day-to-day management of Al-Qaeda's global operations. And lo and behold, the CIA starts digging into these files and they find that the exact opposite is true. That in fact, he was not only managing this network, but he was in many cases micromanaging it. And there's a whole story there about how that assessment was changed behind closed doors, and yet it didn't really affect much of the public discourse at all. And so part of the reason why I agitated to get the files released was to show people what was in them and explain to people, give them a more accurate, in my mind, sense of how this all works.
So before we dive into the source material, what was in there, from a kind of tactical perspective, I would wonder, you know, why would they even release them to the public? You know, because my thought is, okay, well, doesn't the CIA have analysts, and don't they have the ability or the kind of the mandate to go through and learn from all that stuff and then apply the learnings? Like, why would they give it to a guy like yourself?
Well, obviously it wasn't to give it to a guy like me. It was the effort was to put it out there for the public, for anybody to access, all researchers to access. And part of the reason for that was that there were some competing, there have been competing versions, as I said, competing versions or visions of what Al-Qaeda is all along. And my view was, in order to better inform that debate, we should have these primary sources available to as many people as possible to inform it. And what happened was that there were definitely some disagreements behind closed doors within government over the files and how they were handled. And I became privy to that. And I certainly talked to people in Congress and on the Hill, and former CIA director Mike Pompeo knew my whole spiel on it, and others did as well. And eventually, as a result of me making my case that, you know, basically the public discourse would be better served if this stuff was really put out there, they decided to put it out there. And it was very contentious, and there's a lot of details I'm leaving out, obviously. But to me, what I want people to understand is that, you know, just because, as you say, you know, these experts in the intelligence community have access to this and can basically give their opinion on it, and hopefully it informs that, it doesn't mean that they are the last word on any of this. To me, you know, a lot of times, you know, knowledge needs to be spread as widely as possible to have as many different people looking at it to give their assessments of it. And we definitely found things that stick out to us, for example, just in our, with our modest resources, that didn't stick out to intelligence analysts. So, you know, or at least not in the way it should, in our opinion. So the bottom line is, the more the stuff is out there, the better. And there've been definitely benefits to putting the stuff out there.
I would agree with that. So in terms of bin Laden actually being involved in the day-to-day operations, what was he working on?
The short answer is a lot. So the best way I would describe this is that bin Laden received these regular, what I've termed management papers, management memos, from his right-hand man, a guy known as Atiyah Abdulrahman, a Libyan who was very, very highly regarded within Al-Qaeda and jihadist circles. He's someone who was considered to them to be an expert theologian. So he's somebody who had the right religious credentials to weigh in on all matters, because that's the perspective they're coming from. And Rahman really served as this basically aide-de-camp or general manager for Al-Qaeda, overseeing their operations. And he would collect, basically acted as a funnel for all these different Al-Qaeda parties around the globe to funnel information through him to bin Laden. And Atiyah, what he would do is he would write down these management memos that would summarize all of the hot issues of that week, or however, whatever the period is he was reporting to bin Laden on, whether it be, sometimes it'd be a couple weeks, but usually it was a pretty regular basis, certainly within every month of the last final months of bin Laden's life. And those issues involved everything from Hamza bin Laden, Osama's son, being released from Iran, and how are they going to protect him, to you know, what Shabab was doing in Somalia and how that oath of allegiance from Shabab to Al-Qaeda should read, and what Shabab should be doing in terms of managing its nascent state that it's building, to the affairs of what was going on in Iraq. One of the names that pops up, of course, is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the future head of ISIS and the Islamic State, which declared itself to be a caliphate. At the time, he was certainly within Al-Qaeda's scheme, so to speak, and there's conversations about him taking over the Islamic State of Iraq and what that would mean. Operations in Afghanistan, operations in Pakistan, trying to negotiate a ceasefire with the Pakistani government, dealing with Iran and the Iranians and how complex that issue is. I mean, you know, basically, I can keep going on and on and on. The point is that there are a lot more issues on bin Laden's desk than anybody thought as of April 2011. They get these files and they realize, lo and behold, actually bin Laden's touching on all these different matters.
Yeah, and the narrative was that he was just retired, right? He was just living in the mountains. And
yeah, and that narrative. So let's get to it, because this is why I was interested in coming on your podcast. So that in my field, there are a lot of narratives, right? And this is one of the narratives. The narrative that was fed to Peter Bergen of CNN, who wrote a book on Bin Laden and the hunt for Bin Laden, and to David Ignatius of the Washington Post and to others, came from the Obama White House. And the narrative was that Bin Laden was retired. He was out of the game. Now, if you think about it, that's kind of curious, right? Why would people in the Obama White House play down Bin Laden's role in Al-Qaeda at the time of his death? Because obviously this is the signature accomplishment of the Obama years, is to get the head of Al-Qaeda, the guy who brought us 9/11. Why would they play down his importance? And the answer from my perspective is that there was a big push at the time to say, we got Bin Laden, it's over, Al-Qaeda's dead, jihadism, as far as it being a concern for the Americans, is dead, and let's get out of here and don't worry about this anymore. And so that was the narrative that came along with it. And so they spoon-fed this idea to select several people that Bin Laden was in retirement. That's actually the phrase that even Bergen uses in his book. And for David Ignatius of the Washington Post, he wrote a column that says that Bin Laden was a lion in winter. Well, a couple things about that. One, that's not what the CIA found. The CIA, you can go to Mike Morrell, who was the acting CIA director. He has a book called something like The Great War or something along those lines. It's a pretty good book. And he explains how actually, no, the file showed the exact opposite, that he was the opposite of being in retirement, the opposite of being a lion in winter. He was very much still in the game and managing these global affairs. And two, we now have the files released to the public, and I could say definitively that narrative was wrong. I could show you all sorts of ways in which Bin Laden was not in retirement. And then three, of course, to their credit, I would say both Bergen and Ignatius basically, without saying so, walked back from that conclusion that was given to them by the White House back in the days. They basically tracked back from that and said, no, actually, you know, Bin Laden was much more involved in managing Al-Qaeda's affairs. So that was a narrative that was around the files that was spoon-fed to certain select people, including analysts at the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, which put out a pretty flawed analysis of only 17 of the files, which was also another reason why we fought to get the files released, because the narrative that was in that assessment was that Bin Laden was basically sidelined. They asked it as a question in the title and then proceeded to more or less answer it that yes, he was. So this was a spoon-fed narrative that came out in 2012 from the Obama administration, and it sort of stuck in a lot of places. And we could say definitively the files refute that narrative.
Why would they want that narrative? Because in my mind, if you take a guy out and he's still at the top of his game, that seems more impressive.
Well, that's what I just explained, because that's the right question. And I had the same question. And it's because they wanted to say that Bin Laden was basically it. Bin Laden and a handful of others was all we really had to worry about in terms of Al-Qaeda. And all these other groups out there, like the predecessor to ISIS, for example, which they subsequently labeled the JV team, or Shabab in Somalia, or groups fighting in Afghanistan.
So it was the overarching narrative of jihadism has been defeated.
It's local. It's all local now. You don't have to really worry about any international threat to the U.S. We can retreat from everywhere and not have to worry about it. That was the bigger narrative, is a bigger foreign policy narrative, that to set the foreign policy agenda to say America doesn't really have to worry about these groups anymore. So let's get out of here because Bin Laden's dead. And that was really the only thing holding it together as a focus on the U.S. And that's not true either. It shows a fundamental misunderstanding of all this. But that was the larger narrative. And it did, you know, as I said, it is curious, right? I mean, you would think they would be trumpeting Bin Laden's role and showing how important he was. But to give you further evidence for what I'm saying, one of the key actors in this was John Brennan, who was the counterterrorism advisor for President Obama, and he goes on to be CIA director. He gave a speech for the Wilson Center in 2012, in which he cherry-picked from the documents just as President Obama did. And he said something along the lines of that, you know, Osama bin Laden struggled to communicate with other Al-Qaeda affiliates elsewhere. Not true. I mean, yeah, communications were disrupted at times, but I could show you a whole series of communications with multiple Al-Qaeda so-called affiliates throughout the final year of his life. Just didn't make any sense. But that was all part of a narrative for Brennan in that speech, that was he could envision the end of Al-Qaeda within the following decade. Well, lo and behold, we haven't gotten there yet, but we're sitting here in 2021, and I can tell you Al-Qaeda is still very much alive. So that was all false.
For this podcast, I think it would be helpful for myself and the audience if we weave in and out of kind of setting the stage and then getting into the nuance. And so a setting the stage question is, what is the difference between ISIS and Al-Qaeda? And furthermore, based off my prior knowledge, was Zarqawi basically the founder of ISIS, like the precursor back in, I think it was like 04, 05, was that the split? Because didn't it start from Al-Qaeda in Iraq?
Yeah, what I would do is to set the narrative even before we got to Bin Laden files, I would have taken a step back and just start talking about what is Al-Qaeda. Because I said at the outset, there's that seems like a very simple question, and it is a very simple question, and yet there are no simple answers. There aren't any clear answers given by a lot of people in the U.S. government. Basically, I mean, just think about it this way, Jeff. So the U.S. has been involved in these conflicts now for, you know, the better part of 20 years, and even before 9/11 was involved in hunting down Al-Qaeda. The last time the U.S. government produced, to my knowledge, any kind of wire diagram or overview of what Al-Qaeda looked like as an organization was in 2004 in the 9/11 Commission report. Well, we're sitting here in 2021 and 17 years later, I can't think of a similar overview of what Al-Qaeda looks like that the U.S. government has produced during the time in between then and now. And that's a pretty big hole. I mean, and what I would say is, it may sound strange, but there's a very basic epistemological problem here, which is, you know, what is Al-Qaeda? What is it meant to do? How is it structured and how does it go about its business? And so because there's such a lack of clarity on this, it opens up the field to all sorts of clearly erroneous interpretations of this. But Al-Qaeda, I think the best way to understand it for all this is that Al-Qaeda has always been a terrorist organization, sure. But terrorism was always a tactic or a tool that they used to try to achieve their political objectives. First and foremost, it has always been a revolutionary organization. Now, an evil revolutionary organization for sure. But Bin Laden and his not so merry men looked at the world in the late 1980s and they said, boy, there are all these Muslim majority governments that are not ruling according to Sharia or our interpretation of Islamic law. And we want to topple them and replace them with the austere form of governance that we favor. But how do we do that? How do we go about doing that? And at first, there's this idea that Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda was myopically focused on just the far enemy, on the U.S. And certainly they did end up making the U.S. the primary target for a time. But the U.S. has never been their only target. They were also focused on all these so-called near enemies, so these local regimes. They just failed to overthrow them. They failed to overthrow, you know, jihadists failed to overthrow the government of Egypt. They failed to overthrow Gaddafi for a long time anyway. In Libya, they failed to overthrow the Assad regime. And so the idea was, when we look at it from this perspective, from the Jihadist perspective, they thought, well, why is it that we're failing to overthrow these regimes? And they came to believe that everything was tied into this Zionist crusader conspiracy and that the U.S. was propping up this entire system and that they needed to weaken or strike the U.S. in such a fashion the U.S. would recede from the world and that would loosen up create the political space for their jihadi revolution. So that basically hit the U.S. and then they could topple what was then the Hosni Mubarak's regime in Egypt or the Saudi regime or any one of these others, and the U.S. wouldn't come to their aid, and then they could then put in place their jihadi government.
So it was not...
Does that make sense to you as a basic overview? Yeah.
It does make sense. I was under the impression that Bin Laden's goal was, in 9/11, was to actually draw us in and create a divide between the West and Islam.
So... there were always two competing and contradictory reasons given for 9/11 and 9/11 style attacks. Remember, you have the embassy bombings before that. You have the USS Cole sure. attack. You have other plots. There are always two competing and contradictory sort of rationales given for that within Al-Qaeda. The first was, if we hit them, it'll drive them out, just like the Iranians and Hezbollah drove the U.S. out of Lebanon in 1983. So following, you remember the attacks, the simultaneous attacks on the U.S. embassy and the French, the headquarters of the French paratroopers in Lebanon in 1983, the U.S. eventually retreated from Lebanon. And basically that was, bin Laden was watching probably then from Pakistan or Afghanistan. And that was a big sign to him that America was a paper tiger, in his words. And then he looked at what happened with Black Hawk Down in Somalia in the early 1990s, an event that Al-Qaeda certainly had a heavy hand in. And he saw how the U.S. got out of Somalia after that. And he thought, well, you know, this confirmed his suspicion or his idea that basically if we hit them hard enough, they'll just get out of all these areas and that will open up the space for us, for the jihadis to launch their political revolution. So that was the first idea behind it. Obviously, that didn't happen. You know, obviously, the U.S. didn't fall back from the world. The U.S. went in and toppled the Taliban's regime in Afghanistan and then went forward with the what turned out to be strategically disastrous Iraq war and various other actions. And so at that point, the rationale shifts from if we hit them hard enough, we'll force them out right now to we'll draw them in and bleed them dry. And then eventually they'll go home. And when they go home, they won't come back. And so that's the model they've been pursuing ever since for the last 20 years, basically, for most of the last 20 years, since the aftermath of 9/11 anyway. And what you can find within the Al-Qaeda discourse is that those two competing ideas will sit next to each other at times in a very uncomfortable way. But those have been the two primary reasons given at given time, at any given time. Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense. It sounds like it's an ever evolving organization, which is why we have a hard time of defining it is what you're talking about in what their objectives are. I do want to go back even a little bit further to the origin stories here. So as you know, my knowledge in this space is basically the reading The Looming Tower. And, you know, that book goes deep into how bin Laden was basically just a rich kid who took his money and went and established this services bureau in Afghanistan during the fight with the Soviets. And correct me if I'm butchering this at all.
He worked with the, it's Maktab al-Khidmat as the services bureau. That was actually established by Abdullah Azzam, with whom bin Laden worked. And Azzam is basically the godfather of modern jihadism. He's the one who issued the original fatwas or religious edicts that said that jihad is incumbent on all Muslims as long as any Muslim land the size of even one hand is occupied by the infidels. It's then incumbent on individual Muslims around the world to wage jihad until that land is liberated. And that fatwa obviously applied to Afghanistan, but it applied to elsewhere as well. And that's how it was written. And Azzam worked closely with bin Laden until his mysterious death in 1989.
Right. Did bin Laden kill Azzam?
I think that's highly doubtful. Obviously, nobody really knows who killed Azzam. I don't know of any real evidence that he did. There's another competing theory that Egyptians who were working with bin Laden, including people in al-Zawahiri circle, were responsible. I haven't found any persuasive evidence along those lines at all. The bottom line is we don't know to this day.
Okay. So Zawahiri, that's someone I'm very interested in hearing about. So back in the 80s, I believe late 80s, they, you know, bin Laden and Zawahiri link up. And I guess the story is that bin Laden is the one funding a lot of this stuff. Maybe he's got the grand dreams, but that Zawahiri is more of an operator, perhaps. He's more studied in the religious text. Is that all correct? How does Zawahiri enter the picture and team up with bin Laden?
You know, I mean, that's certainly the impression you get from some of Lawrence Wright's writings is that Zawahiri is the man behind bin Laden. And I just would always be careful with these types of dichotomies in terms of how we describe these guys. I mean, the way I look at it is they had a partnership and, you know, neither one of them neither one of them only had a few talents. They both had multiple talents that they brought to this partnership in terror. And Zawahiri certainly is a highly intellectual jihadi. He's somebody who has clearly an above average IQ. He was a doctor, obviously, in Egypt. He comes from a very affluent family in Egypt. He chose the jihadi path. He's somebody who, to my mind, is actually the most underestimated jihadi of all time. He, in all likelihood, although we can't say for certain, in all likelihood, he's still alive somewhere in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. And if you think about that, and this is what I always say to anybody when I talk about this is, imagine if you were hunted by the world's lone, what was, well, America was a superpower, I would say, for part of the period after 9/11. I doubt that it is now, but hunted by America and other powers for decades at a time, could you survive on the lam? This guy has. I know I couldn't. I don't think I could at all. I don't think that would be possible, but he has. And he still has thousands of jihadis who are loyal to him around the globe, despite all the management problems he has overseen or had to deal with. But he was always a close partner of bin Laden going back to the late 1980s, as you said. He's somebody who certainly left his imprint on what we know as Al-Qaeda from the first days of the organization.
So we don't know if he's still alive. I assume that means that we don't know if he's still active.
Well, I'd be very careful. So when I say we don't know that he's dead, I don't see any real evidence that he's dead. I see some very specious reports on Twitter from sources I don't trust saying that. And then I don't think that's accurate. I do know, for example, that there are indications that he's been active. For example, I mean, they're not recent within the last couple of months, but then again, this is a clandestine organization. We're not going to know much about its inner workings, but I'll give you one example from not so distant past. In September 2019, the US and its Afghan allies killed a courier who was running messages back and forth between the head of Al-Qaeda and the Indian subcontinent, which is the Al-Qaeda group principally responsible for fighting in Afghanistan on behalf of the organization, between the head of that group, who was Asim Omar, who was killed in the raid, and Zawahiri. And so we know there's been traffic going back and forth to Zawahiri. I've seen reports of it since then. I've seen reports of it as into 2020 that, in fact, Zawahiri was even consulting with the Taliban, including the Haqqanis, or another organization that's very interesting. We could do a whole other series of podcasts on them if we wanted to, about the so-called peace talks between the U.S. and the Taliban. Zawahiri was talking to various Taliban figures about that. So there are indications he's been active, at least, you know, at different points in 2020. This rumor came about in late 2020 that he was dead, but I have not seen any evidence to justify that rumor, I would say.
My naked guess on why we have not been able to go out and kill him, whether that is the will or the ability, or both, is that the way that policy in practice actually gets implemented is based off of narratives, and that's how the public understands the world. And America loves thinking about organizations with, you know, the great man. That's what it is. The great man, right? So companies are built by a great man. You have the president acting alone. And so my thought here is that perhaps all of our will or ability was all focused on bin Laden and going back into that narrative, because I don't think the public really knows who Zawahiri is. I don't think a majority of the public knows. So why would we waste resources if you're a politician to say, hey, we got this guy that may or may not be active and nobody really knows who he is? Is there any truth to that? Am I in the right direction?
There's some truth to that. What I would say is this. I think I totally agree with the latter point. I don't think the public at large knows who Zawahiri is. And then a lot of the people who are actually experts on this matter, subject matter, will poo-poo him immediately. And I think wrongly. I think for a lot of reasons wrongly. You know, it's obvious from the bin Laden files, which you asked about earlier, that Zawahiri was very much weighing in on all sorts of decisions and guiding people as far away as West Africa within the Al-Qaeda network. This is somebody who is always had an immense cadre behind him. It's not the case that he is some spent force who never had any pull within the jihadi movement or within Al-Qaeda. He always did. And there was, you asked too about the rise of ISIS. We'll get back to that, I'm sure, in a second, but certainly the rise of ISIS caused a lot of problems for him. But as part of that rise of ISIS, one of the things that was interesting is that the Al-Qaeda loyalists, some of them came out of the woodwork, and you could see just how much influence Zawahiri had over them in Syria or Yemen or in different places in Africa. So, you know, this is a guy who has been underestimated, I would say, by a lot of people. That's probably played into it. I think I wouldn't say that America hasn't put any resources into trying to kill him. They certainly have. The CIA and others have. If you remember, in 2009, there was the suicide bombing at Camp Chapman in Afghanistan. And the suicide bomber was a Jordanian doctor who the CIA and Jordanian intelligence thought could deliver Zawahiri to U.S. intelligence, give his whereabouts so we could actually, the U.S. could actually locate him and kill him. And in fact, he was a double agent, a spy who was actually working on behalf of Al Qaeda, and he blew himself up, killing some CIA officers and others in the process. The trail on that operation leads back to Zawahiri himself. This is one of the ways he's been underestimated. This is a guy who detected that the CIA was closing in on him potentially, or was looking for him, and set and helped along with his lieutenants, including Atiyeh Abdulrahman, the guy I mentioned earlier. They set this trap for the CIA. This is something where, you know, let's give the guy, as evil as he is, a little credit for being an intellectual who's very cagey. So that's part of the story too. I think it's absolutely right, as you mentioned, that the U.S. certainly has not devoted the lion's share of its high value targeting to Zawahiri, but it has devoted some of it to him. And he just is a very cagey old guy.
Now, you're right. We will get to ISIS. I want to ask you an open-ended question, because I know that a lot of your work deals with depicting the structure, actual structure on the ground of how Al-Qaeda operates. And I know you're familiar with all of the deputies and how information goes back and forth. And so getting back to trying to wrap our hands around what Al-Qaeda wants, how does their day-to-day operations perhaps map to your understanding of what they want? Because it does not seem like, at least they're out of the news, right? So it's kind of hard from afar to understand that.
Well, they're out of the news, and they're in the news every day if you know what to look for. So part of the issue is that this idea took hold that Al-Qaeda is only interested in attacking the U.S. and the West. And then an argument was papered on top of that if they fail to do so, then they've been defeated and they're a defunct organization. That's completely false. Their original reason for existence was to, as fanciful as it seemed to U.S. policymakers at the time and at given time since then, the principal objective for Al-Qaeda is to resurrect an Islamic caliphate. So when ISIS comes along in 2013, 2014 and says, ta-da, we did it, this was not something that was new within the jihadi movement or jihadi organizations. This is something Al-Qaeda had been talking about since the late 1980s, certainly throughout the 1990s, and then even after 9/11. In their scheme, they want to build these Islamic emirates in these different places. These are sort of the states, the fiefdoms that are going to be overseen by the different princes. And then these states or Islamic emirates would link up in their scheme to form a new caliphate. The Islamic State of Iraq grew into the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham, or ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. This was originally one of these regional groups under the Al-Qaeda hierarchy that was supposed to build its emirate in Iraq that would ultimately become part of a reimagined new caliphate. And what happens is that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and his lieutenants say, basically, they're the lieutenants in this scheme. If you think about it like a mafia for a second, they're basically the lieutenants to the Don, and Zawahiri is the Don and Baghdadi is the lieutenant. And he says, you know what? I don't want to be a lieutenant anymore. I want to be the Don, and we're going to go for it. And there's all these arguments between them and Al-Qaeda behind the scenes, Al-Qaeda senior leadership. And so eventually Baghdadi just does his own thing and breaks away, and Al-Qaeda disowns him, and he declares the caliphate, and the rest is history. That was very much an organizational schism or break within this quest to build the caliphate. If you look, when I say, if you know what to look for, you can see Al-Qaeda in the news every day. Well, the other parts of Al-Qaeda did not follow much. I would say much of the rest of the other parts of Al-Qaeda, or many of the other parts of Al-Qaeda, did not follow the ISIS path. Some of them did, but most of them didn't. And so if you look at right now in Afghanistan, where the U.S. is retreating from Afghanistan as we record this, Al-Qaeda is heavily invested in resurrecting the Taliban's Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Well, why is it called the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan? Because that's one of these so-called emirates that would link up in a new imagined caliphate. And the fighting there rages on a day-to-day basis. Al-Qaeda is executing operations probably every day, certainly every week, and multiple times every week. It's just that's where their resources are devoted right now. For the lion's share of the resources are to reclaim that emirate on behalf of the Taliban, with the Taliban. Then you have Shabab in Somalia. What are they trying to do? Well, that's a branch of Al-Qaeda that's openly loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, repeatedly so. And what are they trying to do? They're trying to build an emirate in East Africa. And you have Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. in Yemen, which garnered a lot of attention because of the Detroit bombing and the attempted bombing of a Detroit-bound airliner in December 2009 and a series of other attacks, planned attacks against the U.S. Well, that's true. The AQAP has threatened the U.S. and tried to launch these operations and tried to inspire other lone jihadis to do so, and had a hand in events such as the December 2019 shooting at Naval Air Station Pensacola. But that's not AQAP's primary reason for existence. Their primary reason for existence for Al-Qaeda in the Peninsula is to build an emirate in Yemen and then expand it into Saudi Arabia and take over the whole Arabian Peninsula. Then you go to West Africa. You have Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and its various offshoots or new formed entities, including one known as JNIM, which is known in English as the Group for the Support of Islam and Muslims. They're trying to form an emirate in West Africa. You remember back in 2011, 2012, the jihadis took over a lot of Mali. What was the point of that? The point of that was to build this emirate that would then link up with other emirates to reform the caliphate. And then in Syria, you have a muddled picture, but there's a lot of detail I'm giving you there. But I'm sparing you, Jeff, and listeners, all the names of the guys who are running these operations, because I could certainly go into them. But the bottom line is that there's still very much an international Al-Qaeda organization that's launching attacks on a day-to-day basis across this huge land expanse. It's just not well understood to Americans because it's never been articulated to them that this is what they're about. This is what they're doing. And they continue to do it. And they're going to continue to do it even as the U.S. retreats from these fights. And the question really becomes, in the long run, you know, some places they have a better chance of success than others. But the point is that Al-Qaeda is very much in the news, just again, if you know what to look for.
This could definitely be a 3 or 4 hour podcast. We don't have you for that long today, but I think that's obvious.
Well, you walked into a problem here. I've had 3 cups of coffee, and I'm a fast-talking New Yorker as it is, and so I'm a well-caffeinated fast-talking New Yorker. So that's a big problem. But
well, it's
I'm a nerd, and it's all I do is study this stuff. So you know, that's the problem.
Well, it's been reported on this podcast that the audience of the podcast is also highly caffeinated. So there's a match there. Don't worry about it. We'll get into. I really want to get into what's going on in Afghanistan with the pullout. Now, I don't know how you feel about military involvement of the United States across the world. What would you say to the argument of, let's just let these guys have it out over there? It's been 20 plus years. And I know that, you know, there was that narrative around, okay, we finally pulled out of Afghanistan. Well, we still have special operations soldiers in 140 countries around the globe actively. So it's not that that was basically just a headline, I think, but we obviously did took out a lot of our troops in Afghanistan and what's going on there. So what would you say to complete isolationism, or however you want to take that question about how to approach it from a military aspect? I mean, would they just leave us alone?
No, the short answer is no, but look, I think, we've come through this period after 9/11 where I think you had basically the Bush administration overreached, obviously, with the Iraq War, and there were a lot of consequences from that. And that has basically colored the conversation of a lot of different events since then. President Obama came in and he claimed to bring the Iraq War to a responsible end. You know, ISIS rises, whoops, you know, and then he claimed he was going to do the same thing in Afghanistan. He was going to bring that war to a responsible end. And he decided to keep less than 10,000 troops there. The bottom line is that you have this sort of massive buildup during the Bush years because of the Iraq War and the surge there, and then the increasing need for forces in Afghanistan. You peak at about 200,000 troops across those two theaters sometime about a decade ago or a little bit more. And then by the end of the Obama administration, which you're talking about December of 2016, January 2017, as President Trump comes in, that number is far lower. I mean, you're talking about definitely less than 30,000. It's tough to get a total handle on it because the Pentagon is, you know, a little squirrely when it comes to reporting on numbers. But across Iraq, then at that point, a minor contingent in Syria and Afghanistan, it's certainly less than 30,000 at that point across all three, probably less than 25,000, maybe even less than 20,000 total across all those. So you have this massive expansion of the American footprint to fight the jihadis, and then this contraction under Obama. Then you have President Trump comes in and he adds a few thousand troops to Afghanistan initially and then pulls them back. and he adds some smaller increase in forces to Syria and Iraq to fight ISIS, and then pulls them back. But basically, the overall picture doesn't change. It's just sort of reduced down to this, you know, much reduced footprint, I would say, until the very end of the Trump administration, when he pulls out. At this point, you now have 700 troops in Somalia, which is a small growing presence there. He pulls them out. He pulls out, he gets the true presence in Afghanistan down to 3,500. That's what President Biden inherits. And then you still have small contingents in Iraq and Syria. But by the time President Biden takes office, you're talking about really less than 10,000 troops in these different theaters. So the point is, and these are true presences that are not, fortunately at this point, are not taking, we're not taking heavy casualties. That's an important point too. And there are a lot of circumstances surrounding that, which I won't get into all of them, but the point is that they definitely were not taking a lot of casualties. So the idea is, what exactly are we talking about when you talk about the American presence in different places? Because I think when we have these conversations, a lot of times people are reacting to the Iraq war and the surge in forces and this the massive expansion, which is of course was problematic. And I, you know, if we go back in time and change that, I would. But that's certainly not the picture that President Trump inherited. And it's not the picture that President Biden inherited. The question is, should the U.S. keep, and reframing the question, should the U.S. keep small contingents of troops in places like Afghanistan to stand up local partners and allies who are on the front lines against the jihadis? And right now, basically, the answer from President Biden is no. So the U.S. is the 3,500 troops he inherited in Afghanistan are going to be pulled out probably by sometime this summer. He intends to get mostly, if not all, out of Iraq and Syria as well. And so these smaller contingents are going to be out. And it just raises a lot of questions. I mean, yes, you know, are these guys going to leave us alone, the jihadis? I mean, no, there's all sorts of intelligence that they're not going to leave us alone. There's got to be some way for the U.S. to monitor these groups after the withdrawal. It's going to get more difficult to do so. And it's going to get more difficult to do so if they start taking territory and are proclaimed the victors in places like Afghanistan. We saw what the victory message did for ISIS. It drove drew in tens of thousands of volunteers from around the globe. I think you could easily see a similar dynamic in some of these places like Afghanistan going forward. That could be a big problem in terms of monitoring all this in the years to come. But the question is, you know, to my mind, I can articulate the counterterrorism rationale for keeping these troops in place and a small contingents in place and keep fighting in these areas and standing up local forces. But on the flip side, I can tell you, and this is where I get where people, I think their ears perk up. I think there's just been such a massive leadership failure here that that the military leadership, the political leadership of this country, the U.S. can't explain any of this to anybody at this point in any reasonable way. And so it's very tough, given those circumstances, for me to support any sort of ongoing presence in any of these countries, I would say.
It certainly does not seem like there has been a plan that has been followed through on. It seems that, at least as a member of the public, we continue to get jerked around a little bit in terms of what's constantly going on. And it just turns into a political football opposed to, you know, what is the long-term goal? What are your thoughts on keeping the presence of special operations in these countries, which, you know, we could go into, you know, is that authorized by Congress or not? But it is happening. So is that kind of the silent failsafe that the U.S. is implementing right now?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one, the U.S. is going to be fully out of Afghanistan, so there not going to be any special operations forces even, other than to protect the embassy potentially in the coming months. They're certainly not going to be involved in any serious war fighting in the country. And I think it'd be tough for them to even protect the embassy after a while. But you know, but let's explore the question you asked about the, you know, congressional authorization a little bit, because I'm very much in the camp that this stuff shouldn't be on autopilot, that there should be congressional authorization for the use of force. And that there needs to be that level of oversight. And Congress has basically punted on these issues and hasn't done its constitutional duty in authorizing this. I mean, it's what I've said. People have a hard time understanding this, like when I talk about these groups, because they think, well, you just want to justify keeping the U.S. in these places. I'm like, if you actually knew everything I knew, you wouldn't be saying that, you know, at all, you know. But the point is, like, you know, I'll give you an example, Jeff, on what you're talking about. So take Shabab in Somalia. I teased the 700 troops that were in Somalia. Let's talk about that for a second. It's absolutely the case that Shabab is part of Al-Qaeda. Okay. Anybody who tells you it isn't is just full of it. It just is. There's just a huge encyclopedia of information at this point about what Shabab is. It's definitely part of Al-Qaeda's stratagem, part of its scheme for what it's trying to do. But there really hasn't been any conversation or direct congressional authorization for the use of force in Somalia outside of the 2001 AUMF, which was, I mean, I'm probably going to get tangled up here. Maybe the lawyers out there are going to say, well, no, there's some other provision that, you know, that the U.S. was able to act under. Fine. But the point is that there was never any real discussion about what should the U.S. be doing with special forces in Somalia. It never was a case where there was a debate on the House floor, let's say, on a resolution to whether or not the U.S. should have a small presence in Somalia to combat Shabab, which is Al-Qaeda's presence there. And so, I think that's a problem, because I think what happens is, I think that opens up the door for all this ignorance I'm talking about on these issues, right? I mean, we don't get to the point of having a conversation of where should we really intervene when the U.S. military is on autopilot and is just helping local forces or intervening in these different places without congressional oversight. If that makes sense to you, like I think to me that's part of what this should be about, right? And if the U.S. if the elected representatives of the American public say, no, we don't want to be in Somalia. Okay, well, then we don't want to be in Somalia. You know, I'm not going to stand in your way, you know. But the point is that debate never really happens the way this went down, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. I think that congressional reform has been a past topic on this podcast, and that's a whole can of worms that I don't think we want to get into. But in terms of the haste towards not only just like the elites in general, but towards the foreign policy community, it sounds like you're saying that a lot of that comes from the fact that the public is not cued in on this stuff. And it's not even, you know, they find out that somebody dies and it's like, oh, well, I didn't even know we had people in Somalia. And that is
the troops in Niger are a great example of that, killed by ISIS, right? You know, we had several troops killed a couple of years back in Niger, you know, hunting ISIS, and nobody even knew they were there doing that. Very few people did. And look, I mean, this is the way I look at this stuff is, and by the way, so here's what's interesting about all this and why there's all these twists and turns to all this stuff. One of the expressions I've coined is the disconnect the dots crowd. So a lot of, just as I said, there's no analytic agreement on what Al-Qaeda is, for example. One of the main reasons for that is because if, in the way a lot of analysts or experts think, and I've debated these people, is if you say that Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is Al-Qaeda, right, then the U.S. is going to intervene militarily there. So then they create all these arguments to justify their tortuous interpretation of an Al-Qaeda group not being Al-Qaeda. I mean, it's just logically absurd, right? My view has always been different, right? I think it's obvious that Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb, which is headquartered in West Africa now, is part of Al-Qaeda. I can give you all sorts of nerdy details if you want to dispute me on that, right? And I can debate you on that all day. But it clearly is. It's why it's called Al-Qaeda, right? But that doesn't mean I want the Marines to go into Mali, right? I mean, you have to be able to bifurcate your analysis of what these groups are and what the jihadi threat is versus what you think should be done about it. And the problem is that this is all messed up. Like, you know, because you have the U.S. military on autopilot, a lot of times they don't even really understand the groups that they're helping to intervene against. Believe me, that's absolutely true in Afghanistan after all these years. There's a lot of confusion about who they're even fighting in Afghanistan. You have the U.S. military sort of on autopilot on these issues. Then you have this expert or analytical cadre, which is saying, no, none of these groups are really part of Al-Qaeda or pose a threat, and so the U.S. shouldn't be fighting any of them. And then, you know, I think I don't want to play the game of the truth is somewhere in between, but probably the truth is somewhere in between. You know, the U.S. should have some ability to counter, you know, the worst of the terrorist threats coming our way. That certainly would have helped against ISIS, for example, when it was rising. But this a more nuanced debate about all this, a more, you know, limited framework for understanding this stuff is sort of out of our grasp at this point, because it's all or nothing. It's all either, you know, either the U.S. is involved in an endless war in Afghanistan, or, you know, we're getting right out of everywhere.
And that's the narrative.
Right.
Let me throw you a curveball for a second and give you a total hypothetical. If we would have got bin Laden at Tora Bora, how much different would the country and world affairs look like?
Well, it's something, I don't know if you saw my tweets on this or if you heard me talk about this before, but I've posed this hypothetical myself, because I run a website called the Long War Journal, and that's not because I've ever pined for this to be a long war, right? I would have very much preferred all this to be a short war. We could not think about it. I mean, 2001, I was an economist, and I could have very much stayed in finance or economics and not done any of this. I probably would have preferred, quite frankly, to have done so. But the thing is that if the U.S. had gotten bin Laden and Zawahiri and really the Al-Qaeda senior leadership annihilated most of them in 2001, I think the picture probably would have been very different. I think it mattered that the U.S. didn't get him, didn't get these guys, the main guys in 2001. And what I would say, by the time the U.S. finally did catch up with bin Laden in 2011, the picture was very different. Bin Laden was a jihadi revolutionary. He wanted to spark his revolution. I would say he succeeded, partly because of American errors, partly because of his own savvy and his own skill and the skill of his loyalists like Ayman al-Zawahiri and others, and the potency of the ideology in certain places, even though it's a very much a minority, a small minority, really, of the overall broader Muslim community, of course. Is jihadi, a very small percentage of it, but still big enough to be demographically a problem. And then they exploited all these local conditions in places like Somalia and West Africa and the Pashtun belt and straddling Afghanistan, Pakistan to their own advantages. They had certain demographic factors to their play. But the point is that if the U.S. had gotten bin Laden and his not so merry men in late 2001, I mean, really most, if not all of them, I don't think that the world would have looked the same way. I think that, you know, he was the evil great man of history who helped spark a jihadi revolution. And that's part of the reason why we're dealing with it now.
That one stings, to be honest, that one stings to think about. Jeff,
let me give you one following thing there. And I know I talk a lot, but let me give you one following thing.
Oh, I love
this.
It.
This is the narrative monopoly, right?
That is right.
So let's talk about a narrative. One of the narratives is that the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 was an overwhelming success. I've been challenging that narrative for years. Is that narrative true? I don't think so. I don't think overthrowing a ragtag regime like the Taliban that didn't have an air force and didn't have any real conventional military forces to speak of, but failing to get bin Laden, Zawahiri, and the other masterminds and chief components of Al-Qaeda, and failing to get Mullah Omar, who steadfastly defied the U.S. and refused to turn over bin Laden, and in fact was working with bin Laden, contrary to what some people claim, failing to get him, right? I don't think that was a successful operation. I think it was a failure. I think overthrowing a ragtag Taliban regime is not really some big military success. In 2001, the all-American pressure should have been brought to bear to get these guys as quickly as possible and end it. Right. And say, that's it. We're not going to let you keep going. And instead, for a lot of complicated reasons, and I don't know ultimately whose fault it is. I think it's probably multiple people, multiple Americans' faults. Unfortunately, they went in with this cockamamie half-assed plan into Afghanistan. And that's part of the reason why the jihad is raging in Afghanistan this many years later, I would say.
The Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Iraq right now. You recently wrote a piece titled "The Taliban and Al-Qaeda Are Closing In on Afghanistan's Provincial Capitals." And let me read the summary part that you have on there. For the past two decades, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have waged an insurgency against the Afghan government. They have pursued a fairly basic strategy: seize the rural areas while preparing the ground for an assault on population centers. They have woven nooses around at least several of Afghanistan's provincial capitals, knowing that they would eventually tighten the rope. That day has come. What's going on over there?
Well, it's just a classic Maoist insurgency. You know, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban's military commanders have studied Mao, and the one of the principal, you know, Maoist techniques is to capture the rural terrain, surround the populated centers, and eventually take the population centers when the circumstances shift in your direction. And in this case, it's the principal selling point or benefit to the U.S. and NATO having forces in Afghanistan from a warfighting perspective has been that the provincial capitals of Afghanistan have remained out of the jihadis' clutches. As the U.S. and NATO now withdraws and their presence is coming to an end, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have decided that they can start to expend the manpower that's necessary to take and hold these provincial capitals. So they've been testing this for a while now. We were documenting this as far back as 2015. What they do is, in some cases, they would go in and capture provincial capital, but they wouldn't expend the manpower to hold it because they knew that the U.S. with its superior special operations capability and air power could come in and save the day and keep the capital from falling. But now these capitals without that capacity in Afghanistan, now it's the time has come for the Taliban to launch. It's quickly approaching that they're going to launch their full fledged offensive. We haven't seen the full thing yet. They're just priming the pump. They're getting ready for it. And they want to overthrow these provincial capitals because that's the first key to taking back all of Afghanistan and resurrecting an Islamic Emirate. And so you have the potential now of sometime in the next year or so of seeing hundreds of thousands of people fall under, perhaps even more, perhaps even millions fall under Taliban Al-Qaeda rule, which means that they will then be subjected to the Islamic law as they see it. Now, of course, as I also write in the piece, life in these provincial capitals is far from idyllic. This is not, I'm not painting some rosy scenario of Afghanistan, but certainly I would say for the Afghan civilians, for many of them, they would certainly prefer to be under this makeshift, problematic, corrupt government than they would be under the Taliban Al-Qaeda. But unfortunately, the Taliban jihadi governance is coming.
With the quote unquote peace talks, I mean, did we basically just take the L?
Take the L is a good way of putting it. Yeah, the thing is, as I actually argued with the people who were behind this at the time, I said, look, if the time has come to get out of Afghanistan, just get out of Afghanistan. You don't have to capitulate to the Taliban. You don't have to surrender to the Taliban and grant them all sorts of concessions. Unfortunately, the Trump administration, instead of just getting out of Afghanistan, took this approach. The peace talks have always been a farce. There are no peace talks. This is all a Washington construct. The Taliban just showed up in Doha and said, we're here for our concessions. Thanks for showing up. And the U.S. gave them a number of concessions. And then the Taliban went right back to its war fighting, never stopped, launched offensives. What they said was basically the only thing the U.S. got out of this was the Taliban said, all right, we'll let you guys retreat without attacking Americans, as we can. And so we'll let you retreat out of here. That's it. You didn't really need to have this phony pretense of peace talks to achieve that. You could have reached a deal that was that simple with the Taliban to say, look, either you let us retreat or you're going to force us to bomb you as we retreat. And basically, I think the Taliban would have given us the deal and just said, get out. But instead, the State Department built this entire house of cards, which is all nonsense about, how the Taliban, portraying the Taliban as an actor that was actually interested in peace and a political reconciliation and that was willing to break with Al-Qaeda. And absolutely none of that was true. None of it.
Does the Taliban have an appetite to sponsor another bin Laden type figure? I mean, because that's originally why we went after them, right? It was because they were harboring bin Laden. And I mean, outside of the fact that, they're going to make the average Afghani citizen's life hell, what is the incentive to beat back the Taliban? Is it the bin Laden sponsorship 2.0?
No, it's a good question. I mean, obviously if it were just about, there are a lot of bad regimes out there and the U.S. can't go and topple them all to try and free the people underneath them. It's just not the way the world. It's not a good use of American, not a smart or wise use of American resources. So it's a good question. I would say, just to put a fine point on it, when it comes to pre-9/11 Afghanistan, Taliban apologists, and these are creatures in the counterterrorism world who basically have invented this fictional narrative of the Taliban to say that they weren't really in bed with Al-Qaeda prior to 9/11 or even today. That's just total nonsense. I mean, all 19 hijackers were trained in Afghanistan. Yeah, it's true they came from different places and they went to different places afterwards, but that plot came together in Afghanistan. It would not have come together without the safe haven that bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had in Afghanistan. They allowed to operate training camps, allowed them to indoctrinate, recruit, and identify talent for a 9/11 style operation. If you remember in 1996, bin Laden is ejected from Sudan. He doesn't have a place to go until he gets a welcoming party in Afghanistan, and the Taliban absolutely welcomes them. You can see it in the 9/11 Commission report. And Mullah Omar refuses to break with bin Laden or give him up. And in fact, there's some evidence he even approved it, some cases of what bin Laden was doing. And you could see in Mullah Omar's own rhetoric in a Voice of America interview he gives in 2001, September 2001, after 9/11, he basically is repeating all the Al-Qaeda talking points about that and other attacks. So there's just a wealth of evidence about the integration of Al-Qaeda into the Taliban's operations in Afghanistan prior to 9/11. The story has evolved, but it's very much remains the same case to this day. The difference now is that Al-Qaeda doesn't need Afghanistan to train all 19 hijackers like they did prior to 9/11, because they can train them anywhere. Not anywhere, but in several countries now. And so now the threat it has is definitely distributed. The issue for me is that, yes, I think the threat of global terrorism goes up as the jihadis make gains in Afghanistan, but it's not as simple as saying we need to stay there to prevent another 9/11, because they could try something big in the West, and probably not 9/11 style attack, but something similar. They could try something big in the West again, but use other countries as staging grounds for them. For example, Somalia, where Shabaab is, or Yemen, where AQP is, or Syria, or West Africa. There's all sorts of places they could conceivably launch something from, or all of them, in fact. They could have parts of it come from these different places. The issue is that if you think about what the rise of ISIS did to the global jihadi movement, it was a huge shot in the arm. It created all these secondary and tertiary problems for the West, for Europe and the U.S. in terms of monitoring terrorism threats, and having the counterterrorism services keep on top of it. I think the victory in Afghanistan, should the Taliban and al-Qaeda win and resurrect the Islamic Emirate, will be a boon for the global jihadi movement and will have those same types of secondary and tertiary effects, and will undoubtedly increase the terrorist threat globally, is what I would say.
What is the goal of Al-Qaeda?
Well, like I said earlier, the goal is to build this caliphate. Now they're far away from that, and it's been dismissed by American policymakers at times. You remember I cited earlier a speech by John Brennan, who was then the chief counterterrorism advisor to President Obama in 2012. And he, in that same speech, he said that we're not going to organize our counterterrorism policies around the jihadis' goal of building a caliphate, because that's an absurd, feckless delusion. So absurd and feckless delusion were his phrases. And that was June 2012. I think it was, June 2011? Maybe it was June. No, I think it was June 2012. In any event, it was basically a few years to the day that ISIS declared its caliphate in Iraq and Syria, you know? And so what you have is this disjunct where at times American policymakers have said, well, we don't really care about the caliphate's absurd, it's nonsense, we're not going to worry about that. Meanwhile, that's what motivates a lot of the jihadi violence. That's what their main principal political goal is. That's still Al-Qaeda's goal. I'm not saying that they're going to actually build a real caliphate anytime soon, but you know, if they win in Afghanistan, they win in Somalia, they win some other places, then they start having the infrastructure of these emirates in place to at least claim success in that regard.
Yep. Well, I know that we've been on for about our allotted time here, so let me leave an open-ended question for you, which is, we've already touched on it. You've mentioned some false narratives that have been built up, but you, in our exchange before this, you know, you were saying there are a lot of false narratives built up over the last 20 years. Are there any others that you would like to hit on?
Well, I think to recap, because obviously I talk a lot, so hopefully people are following along.
I mean, that's perfect for a podcast. So
I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. But you know, I mean, the first narrative is that Al-Qaeda was only interested in attacking the U.S. and the West. That was false. It's always been false. It's still false. And it was always false. Obviously, Bin Laden's gone, but they are interested in attacking the U.S. and the West. Yes, but that's not their sole interest or their sole motivation, reason for existence at all. A second narrative has been that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are not joined at the hip. They are. There's a wealth of evidence that they are. In fact, what's funny to watch is the official assessments now at the end of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan have come around to the minority report that we kept issuing at Long War Journal for all these years, and are now saying, yeah, in fact, they are closely tied together. Yeah, I wish the U.S. had gotten that right a lot sooner, because there was a lot of things could have been done differently, but didn't now they're at the end. And I think another narrative is that the U.S. just needs to focus on great power competition when it comes to Russia and China and forget about all this. I think that, as I said earlier, I think the bulk of our resources as Americans have already been shifted away from the post 9/11 conflicts. I think it makes sense to shift most of the resources away. I think it makes sense to worry about China. I've written a lot about China recently myself, because it's something that I was tracking for 6 years before I started writing about it. I think that is a different scale of threat to American interests for sure. But it's not the case that America can shift entirely away from the post 9/11 conflicts and wash its hands of all this and think it's going to be fine. Because I just don't think that's the case.
You did mention earlier kind of an offhand comment in passing. You said America is no longer a superpower. Why do you feel that way?
I don't think the U.S. is a superpower. I think my grand thesis, in short, of what's going on is I think you're witnessing a failure of the American elite. You know, a lot of different ways I could come at this, but in consistent with this podcast, I think what I witnessed in Afghanistan, for example, and this is why I don't, when people say just get out, I don't want to deal with it, I don't dismiss that at all, because believe me, I could probably articulate the problems that I've witnessed in Afghanistan and how the US has prosecuted this war probably just as well as anyone, if not better. There's been a lot of elite failures in Afghanistan from the Americans, just an unwillingness to see the world as it is and get it right, unwillingness to tell the truth. And I think that that has manifested itself in a lot of other ways too. I think you have an American elite now that are not really, don't really want to defend America as a nation or its history. I think we are involved in this incessant game of navel gazing of all of its problems in the, from the past, just constant. And certainly there are many, you know, sins in America's history, of course, you know, but this, it's just constant now. That's all you hear about, it seems to me. And if you look at the American elite on a person by person basis, just take a look around at the different people that have been exposed in recent years. You know, I made a joke recently on another podcast about Henry Kissinger, who in the foreign policy establishment, which is something I deal with and I've dealt with quite extensively, that Henry Kissinger is sort of the Bernie Madoff of the foreign policy establishment. Remember, Bernie Madoff was this elite in the finance world, thought to be the world's super investor, and he was just running an elaborate Ponzi scheme. You know, Henry Kissinger was basically doing that only with China as his foil for the Americans, you know, basically profiting off of, you know, dealing with the Chinese and serving their interests more than the American interests for decades. And nobody's called him on it, you know, or very few people call him on it. That type of failure of the American elite, I think, is very tough to come to grips with. But I think that if you start looking at the world that way, what's going on within America now, I think that there's a lot more I could say about it, but that's basically where I'm looking at it. And I think when you lose your will to defend your own nation's history and your own nation, and you are incessantly involved in trying to undermine it, I think you're a spent force.
We'll have to touch on Kissinger in the next time you come on the airwaves, because I know you have a lot to say there, and I tend to agree.
Well, all I would say is if you better read up on Kissinger before we have that one, because I can give you about 9 hours of content of why I think he's a fraud. So you know, it's not pretty. Like I think he's an intellectual fraud, and I think what is in terms of how he articulates his version of policy is also fraudulent. So I don't really have anything positive to say about him. But the fact that so many people in the foreign policy world have been enamored with him for so long, again, I think is an example of elite failure, is what I would say.
That's fair. You have a book behind you that is Ulysses S. Grant. So it's your Now book. And that's one of my favorites. And I think that we are desperately in need of a Grant right now. I don't think that we've seen one for a long time.
We're gonna need new American leaders. And I don't know if they're out there. And again, they could be men, women of any, you know, America has always been multicultural. It's multiracial. I'm not about any of that stuff. It could be coming from any different sector of our society, but we're going to need new leaders, because the ones we've got now are not getting the job done. And the issue of Grant, of course, as you know, the history, and as so many prior listeners know, is that Lincoln was desperate for a general who would fight to win. Part of what happened in Afghanistan, by the way, is we didn't find a Grant-like figure to lead the war effort. That's part of the issue. But more broadly speaking, that sort of competition, that sort of trying to find somebody who's going to really fight to win, is really lacking in our U.S. military cadres, I would say, at this point, the top tier. And I think we have had a similar failure of the leadership in the political elite as well.
Yeah, I think Lincoln has that famous quote about Grant, where someone was talking about, oh yeah, it was I can't spare this man, he fights.
Right.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, we need some fighters. Where can people find you?
Well, I tweet very sporadically at my own handle on Twitter. I have very distrustful social media, so that's why I do that. But I also write a lot at the Dispatch for its newish publication. You know, basically formed by people in exile during the Trump years, I would say, and also I write a lot at FDD's Long War Journal, which is where I do a lot of my coverage. And we have a podcast there as well called Generation Jihad, which if you're not sick of listening to me by now, you can tune in, there as well.
All right. Well, I will link to those in the show notes, and thanks for coming on, Tom.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it.
And there you have it. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. Please leave a 5-star written review on Apple Podcasts if you're listening there, and give us a follow or subscribe on whatever you're listening to. And we will see you next week.